During the 1970s, which John Updike derided as a slum of a decade, distrust of all large institutions, from governments to businesses to families, became rampant. As the late great Planet Earth led nonfiction bestseller lists, environmentalists called on Americans to consume less energy and build fewer big things. By living in a more passive harmony with outer nature, it was thought, Americans could reach truer harmony with their inner natures. This declinism sapped the nation's workplace productivity, without, however, quelling any thirst for goods. Combined with two inflationary oil price shocks, the result was a growthless stagflation. Even today, more than two decades later, America's average real take-home wage has yet to regain its 1973 level. Late in the awakening, the nation reeled from blows that would have been inconceivable in the high. Gas lines, the Iran hostage crisis, and a plummeting dollar. Americans were now fully absorbed into what Christopher Lash called the culture of narcissism, feeling the best way to approach life was not, as in the high, to start with the community and move in, but to start with the self and move out. The awakening's last act was for ideological conservatives to reach the same conclusion and thereby launch a huge political revival. During the tax cut fever of the late 1970s and the rise of Ronald Reagan in 1980, conservatives at last gave up on the establishment. Agreeing that, yes, the individual is infinitely more virtuous than the state, they discovered to their delight that a society full of autonomous individualists was the perfect soil for a re-energized Republican Party. By the end of Reagan's first term, the awakening had run its course. Between 1964 and 1984, America's inner yearnings surged and its outer discipline decayed. At a distance, awakening eras are memorable for their images of contrasting extremes, the triumph of power, wealth, and knowledge, side by side with the passionate outcry of the spirit. Awakenings produce this mood because of the archetypes then entering a new life cycle phase. Heroes into elderhood, artists into midlife, prophets into young adulthood, and nomads into childhood. Generational differences come into sharp relief as prophets come of age assaulting the hero's constructions. At last unconstrained by the caution of older nomads, aging hero generations enter the awakening at their height of public power. When their hubris is attacked by young zealots, they first battle against the new values, then accede to them. Afterward, they retain institutional power, through which they seek and receive economic reward from the young. As indecisive artists replace heroes in midlife, they apply expertise and process to improve society while calming the passions of the young. They compensate for their earlier conformism by engaging in high-risk institutional and family behavior. Tolerant of discord, artists deflect argument by compromising or postponing unpleasant choices. Having known firsthand only the high and not the crisis, young adult prophet generations take for granted the comforts and indulgences of the new secular order. They burst forth with angry challenges to the older hero's grand constructions, which they regard as intolerably deficient in moral worth. Eventually, they persuade others to join the pursuit of individual autonomy at the expense of social cooperation. Nomad generations have the misfortune to be children in an era when adults are persuading each other to shed social discipline and rediscover their deeper selves. They are expected to grow up fast and learn to be independent, resourceful, and competitive at an early age. As they do, however, these young nomads become metaphors of the society's newfound pessimism about the future. Throughout history, this layering of archetypes has produced awakenings. The years between 1964 and 1984, the consciousness revolution, were no exception. Starting at the top of the awakening's generational constellation, let's take a look at the GIs entering elderhood. By 1966, the majority GI Congress was spending nearly as much money on education and health care in 1 year as earlier Congresses had spent throughout the whole of American history. The list of new legislative constructions was huge. The new civil rights agencies, the Office of Economic Opportunity, Medicare, Medicaid. Together, the achievements of the great 89th Congress confirmed the GI's collective ability to build a great society, fight two wars, one cold and one hot, and reach the moon, too. As Eric Hoffer said of the Apollo program, these generational achievements marked the triumph of the squares. To work as intended, though, the GI edifices required beneficiaries to behave as squarely as they. But as the awakening progressed, younger people did not. The launching of the awakening produced a values clash then known as the generation gap. From hair to clothes to sex to music to tone of voice, everything about the new youth movement struck GI eyes and ears as divisive, passionate, and selfish. Just the opposite of the qualities this aging generation had come to admire in itself. Having conquered half the globe as young foot soldiers, GI leaders never imagined that a small regional war would pose much of a problem. The only two votes against the Tonkin Gulf resolution came from older, lost generation skeptics, Senators Morse and Greening. But once the war was on, neither the troops nor the home front behaved in a way that pleased Lyndon Johnson's generation, and quarrels between parents and children, especially between GI fathers and boomer sons, worsened by the year. The full price of GI hubris was still to be paid. Watergate became the awakening's Thermidor, as two boomers, Woodward and Bernstein, exacted the generation gap's biggest trophy, Nixon's resignation in disgrace. The ensuing congressional election led to the ouster of powerful GI committee chairmen and the enactment of countless new procedural entanglements that made the big new GI-style programs impossible. Nor was this limited to government. After Watergate, GI industrialists constantly heard themselves accused of moral outrages against nature, women, minorities, the poor, and the deepest needs of the human soul. Gradually, GIs gave up arguing with the young, some agreeing with Milton Meyer that we were wrong and the new generation is right. Bit by bit, they acquiesced in a pan-generational ethos of self-indulgence. The generation gap between GIs and their boomer children thus reached a lopsided truce. Boomers won the values debate and control over the culture, while GIs continued to preside over the institutional firmament and gathered a vast public reward. Fueled by the new senior lobby, the last GI Congresses spent the entire post-Vietnam fiscal peace dividend on their own peers. By the late 1970s, transfer payments from younger generations to GIs towered by a 10-to-1 ratio over what remained of Great Society poverty programs. This sudden elder affluence was an extraordinary GI achievement. Through the high, when the lost were old, elder benefits had fallen 20% behind wages. Now, what seniors received from the U.S. government rose 15 times faster than average wages. Where lost elders had been the poorest generation of the high, GI seniors became the least poor generation of the awakening. Younger generations didn't much object to paying taxes to support these extra benefits for seniors because it financed the latter's separation, culturally, geographically, and familially. The new subsidies also induced GIs to vacate the workplace voluntarily, as the youngest retirees in U.S. history. By the awakening's end, GIs had recoined the currency of old age. Never in living memory did America have an elder generation so politically and economically powerful, yet so invisible in the realm of culture and values. While GI senior citizens remained conspicuous as executives and treasurers for national institutions, they began having trouble with what George Bush would later call the vision thing. Hardly any seniors produced films, wrote essays, composed music, or delivered homilies for the benefit of younger audiences. Back in the high, when their generation ran the general issue culture, everything seemed to fit together constructively. Now, deep into the awakening, it didn't. Next, let's take a look at the silent generation entering midlife. The loss of President Kennedy prodded the silent to demand more from what they then called the powers that be. From the nonviolent activism of Medgar Evers to the folk songs of Joan Baez and the Kingston Trio, what some correctly label the civil rights generation tugged on the nation's conscience. Inspired, millions of silent helpmates lent their expertise to the expanding GI edifice and their sympathy to burgeoning youth movements. Soon, two more tragedies brought tears to this generation. This time, the two fallen heroes were the silent's own, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, whom many felt then and now were the two best they had to offer. Afterwards, the silent, as a generation, would never again feel quite as uplifted by public life. In the Awakening's early years, the silent felt tugged by the contradictory agendas of two quarreling generational neighbors. During the ferment of the 60s, a period of the famous generation gap, we occupied, unnoticed as usual, the gap itself, Wade Green recalled. Lacking an independent voice, middle-aged people adopted the moral relativism of the arbitrator, mediating arguments between others, and reaching out to people of all cultures, races, incomes, ages, and disabilities. The tensions they felt helped them become America's greatest generation of songwriters, comedians, and therapists. The Awakening sexual revolution hit the silent at an awkward phase of life, just when they had kids at home. Silent men felt claustrophobic, women resentful. From 1969 through 1975, as the silent surged into state legislatures, the number of states with no-fault divorce laws jumped from 0 to 45. While all generations joined the divorce epidemic, the silent showed the steepest age bracket rise and emerged with the deepest residual guilt. Still craving respect from GI elders, the silent tried to convince boomers that they understood them and could help channel their anger. From the exhortations of Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm X, to the lyrics of Simon and Garfunkel, to the psychedelic art of Peter Max, to the Motown sound of Berry Gordy, silent activists and artists lent expression to youth fury. Having reached the age when GIs had earlier taken charge of America, the silent now resisted the idea that anybody could or should assume GI-style leadership. They plumbed inner wellsprings older GIs seldom felt, while maintaining a sense of social obligation boomers seldom shared. Their solutions, fairness, openness, due process, reflected a keen sense of how and why humans fell short of grand civic plans or ideal moral standards. After they attained a majority of America's congressmen and governors in 1977, their main preoccupation was preventing big institutions from doing bad things to everyday people. They did this by writing impact statements, reviewing market externalities, designing flowcharts, holding hearings, setting up oversight committees, and airing government secrets. In the business world, the silent similarly challenged the GI-style pyramidal structure with a new decentralized M-form corporation. Thanks to this silent-spawned ambivalence, uncertainty, and complexity, building powerful new things, like a 3-mile island, became difficult or impossible. Once productivity stagnated, any response was rendered problematic by silent thinkers like Lester Thoreau, who in Zero Sum Society observed that improving the condition of one group now had to come at the expense of another. Where midlife GIs had done great things and felt a stride history, where young boomers were satisfied to look within themselves, the silent took great things for granted and looked beyond themselves, while worrying that history was passing them by. Now let's look at the boomer generation as they enter young adulthood. Where silent youths had come of age eager to fine-tune the system, cutting-edge boomers wanted it to burn, baby, burn. They had been raised to ask fundamental questions and apply fundamental principles. Where silent nonconformists had feared blotches on their permanent records, boomers perceived few real risks. Amnesty was always the student striker's first demand, and usually it was granted. More important, a supercharged economy was offering careers to all comers. Most campus rioters assumed that the instant they deigned to do so, they could drop back into the American dream machine. Planning for tomorrow was no big deal. Did boomers expect to find better jobs, make more money, and live in better houses than their parents? Certainly, recalls Robert Reich of his student activist days. That is, if boomers wished it, and maybe they didn't. The generation gap was fundamentally a boomer revolt against GI fathers. The most memorable youth symbols were direct affronts against the constructions of GI men, from the two-fingered peace taunt, adapted from the old GI V for victory, to the defiant wearing of khaki, the GI color of uniformed teamwork, and the desecration of the American flag. The emerging boomer agenda was a deliberate antithesis to everything the prototypical GI male had stressed during the high. Spiritualism over science, gratification over patience, fractiousness over conformity, rage over friendliness, negativism over positivism, and especially self over community. The most overt cause of youth frenzy was the Vietnam War, a threat that was generally avoidable for those who actively sought a way out. Only one of every 16 male boomers ever saw combat, and 10 times as many committed draft law felonies, mostly failure to register, as were killed in the war. As the anti-Vietnam fever cooled, the economy became an issue with boomers for the first time. In and after the 1973 recession, entry-level jobs became hard to find. With the economy souring, many boomer post-anti-warriors found new reasons why money-making was beneath them. Having jammed the gears of the silent-era treadmill, boomers wandered off to do what they wanted to do. The self-absorption of young boomers lent their generation, male and female, a hermaphroditic pistol and stamen quality. Having grown up when gender role distinctions had reached a zenith, boomers set to work narrowing them. Men ventured into values domains that in the high had belonged to GI mothers and teachers, while boomer women invaded the careerist roles once reserved for their GI fathers and providers. This made boomers more independent of social bonds, yet also more open to emotional isolation and economic insecurity. Unlike silent women, many boomer women worried from the outset that early marriage might actually depress their future household standard of living. Through the latter half of the awakening, boomers actively crafted new concepts of self-religion. Meanwhile, a new breed of Jesus freaks and born-agains returned the Calvinist notion of calling to its original emphasis on an inspirational rebirth. From New Age fellowships to Southern Baptist churches, believers no longer had to spend a lifetime engaged in GI works to achieve salvation. In their daily lives, young adult boomers began testing their powerful inner concepts on the outer world. As boomers retooled the American economy by insisting on meaningful, read un-GI, careers and products, America's decades-long productivity surge came to an end. Boomers had little desire to produce or purchase the cars or furniture that looked like their neighbors. In pro sports, free spirits like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Reggie Jackson, and Joe Namath introduced the inner athlete and an era of declining loyalties among athletes, teams, cities, and fans. In their hobbies, boomers did everything with an intensity others found obsessive, from exercise faddists looking for the runner's high to diet faddists looking for alpha waves. In the marketplace, consumer brand loyalties weakened, and Made in the USA became passé among the cognoscenti. When the tempest of the awakening began to calm, aspects of life boomers had once deemed spiritually empty, consumption, careerism, family formation, were now temptingly available, having at last been resacralized by their new values. Older and younger generations guffawed at their pick-and-choose idealism, but boomers couldn't forever linger in a state of suspended animation. By now, this generation had come to believe in the credo of the Whole Earth Catalog: we are as gods, and we might as well get good at it. And let's consider the youngest generation of the latest awakening, 13ers entering childhood. Amid the gathering turbulence of 1964, baby-making abruptly fell out of favor. In the spring of that year, American women were still giving birth at a record pace. But in the months that followed, conceptions plummeted, and by mid-1965, the U.S. fertility rate was entering its steep post-boom decline. The reasons for this sudden turn included birth control pills, nascent feminism, and a new society-wide hostility toward children. America's new consciousness celebrated youth as an ideal, but wasted childhood as an actual living experience, moving from what Leslie Fiedler called a 1950s-era cult of the child to what Landon Jones called a 1970s-era cult of the adult. Parents were shunned if they tried to bring small children into restaurants or theaters. More rental apartments started banning children. The ascendant zero population growth movement declared each extra child to be pop pollution, a burden on scarce resources. Sacrificing one's own career or conjugal happiness for the sake of the kids became passé, even, by the logic of the era, bad for kids themselves. Awakening-era parents spent 40% less of their time on child-raising than parents had spent in the high. The Awakening's casual sex, non-traditional families, and mind-altering drugs left a large imprint on this child generation. By the late 70s, once 13ers began practicing what they had learned, adults grew accustomed to seeing kids dress and talk as knowingly as Brooke Shields in ads or Jodie Foster in film. As the media standard for the typical American family changed from "my three sons" to "my two dads," divorce struck 13ers harder than any other child generation in U.S. history. At the end of the high, half of all adult women believed that parents in bad marriages should stay together for the sake of the children. But by the end of the awakening, only one in five thought so. By 1980, just 56% of all 13er children lived with two once-married parents. And today, this generation's novels and screenplays bristle with hostile references to parents who didn't tough it out. Polls have since shown 13ers far more inclined than older Americans to believe current divorce laws are too lax. The events of the Awakening reinforced the impression that grown-ups were neither powerful nor virtuous. To the child's eye, adults were simply not in control, either of their own personal lives or, during the years of Vietnam, Watergate, and gas lines, of the larger world. Instead of preventing danger or teaching by example, adults were more apt to hand out self-care guides that told kids about everything that might happen and how to handle it on their own. It was an era in which everyone and everything had to be liberated, whether it was good for them or not. Nowhere were 13er children more liberated than in Awakening-era schools, where high-era education now stood accused of having dehumanized boomer children. Reformers tried to boost child self-esteem through person-centered education that stressed feelings over reason, empirical experience over logical deduction. The average time children spent on homework fell to half of what it had been in the high era, and grade inflation ran rampant. As the awakening progressed, the percentage of high school graduates who described themselves as straight-A students nearly tripled. The awakening's new hostility to power, authority, and secrecy had one meaning for 45-year-olds seeking a nuanced view of a complicating world, but another for 10-year-olds trying to build dreams. For the silent, taught to think big as crisis-era children, thinking small was a midlife tonic. But never having had their own chance to think big, pre-adolescent 13ers heard a new message. America's best days were over. Like the child of divorce writ large, this generation wondered if it was just a coincidence that they came along just at the moment in history when older people started complaining that everything in America began falling to pieces. During the consciousness revolution, as older generations stripped away the barriers that had previously sheltered childhood, 13ers were denied a positive vision of the future, denied, indeed, any reassurance that their nation had any collective future at all. By the end of Reagan's first term, the awakening had run its course. A new agenda had been set, and the old enthusiasm could not last. Each generation now filled the phase of life it had spent the prior two decades entering, and each was about to break ground into the next. As was the case around 1963, none of the generational archetypes showed signs of matching the role its predecessor had carried into the prior era. How could the silent project anywhere near the hubris of the aging conquerors, building their great society and demanding their entitlement? How could the boomers possibly emerge as midlife mediators, looking beyond themselves for procedural solutions? How could 13ers come of age preaching about moral perfection? How could American parents tolerate yet another underattended child generation? None of that had any chance of happening. Toward the end of any awakening, generational strains begin to show. When the silent begin edging into elderhood, boomers into midlife, and 13ers coming of adult age, their prior social roles could not continue. The awakening was over. As Roland Stromberg had predicted in the middle 1970s, eventually the mood of that era will be revealed as simply one more exhausted option. and so a new one will have to be invented. The second turning necessarily had to give way to the third. The current third turning, called the Culture Wars, began in 1984 and is due to end in approximately 2005. "It's morning in America," exulted President Reagan in his State of the Union message on January 15, 1984. "America is back, standing tall, looking to the 80s with courage, confidence, and hope." As California's governor during the prior era, Reagan had stood firm against the consciousness revolution and symbolized the primacy of the establishment. Now he symbolized the defeat of that establishment and the primacy of the self. Reagan detested the rules and taxes and penalties of the very system he ran, and, buoyed by the feel-good veneer of the economy and moment, people loved it. The awakening was over, and people discovered they were comfortable with what America had become. Early in the unraveling, the postmodern complexities of life struck neoliberals and neoconservatives as exciting new challenges. By the mid-90s, the mood had sobered, with 3 in 4 adults believing the United States to be in moral and spiritual decline. By then, civic attitudes had transformed into the opposite of what they had been in the high. Where America had once experienced what Barbara Whitehead called an economy of abundance and a psychology of scarcity, the nation now had an economy of scarcity and a psychology of abundance. Broad measures of public trust sank to new lows, yet polls also showed Americans awash in self-esteem. Not trusting government, people did trust the individual, as expressed through the marketplace, cultural diversity, interactive technologies, New Age spirituality, and evangelicalism. From TV talk shows to dependency groups to church basements, the search for personal meaning started with the direct experience of the individual. The self-discovered meanings were then ratified by others attracted to the individual's own niche group. Unlike in the high, there was no such thing as normal public opinion. By the early 1990s, America's niche group conflict came to be known as the Culture Wars, defined by Irving Kristol as a profound division over what kind of country we are, what kind of people we are, and what we mean by the American way of life. Three basic battlegrounds emerged: multiculturalists against traditionalists, the Sheldon Hackneys versus the William Bennetts, media secularists against evangelicals, the Murphy Browns versus the Dan Quayles, and public planners against libertarians, the Robert Reichs versus the Charles Murrays. The Culture Wars had as many combatants as America had niches, from the Nation of Islam to the Internet. And the new lexicon of the Culture Wars allowed America's post-awakening ideals to be elevated into ideologies. Americans in nearly every niche came to one common conclusion: the institutional order was not working and was not worth defending. President Clinton, presiding over big government, proclaimed in 1996 that the era of big government is over. From courts to campuses, medicine to media, institutional America bathed in a self-criticism that corroborated the external critiques of the prior era. Americans turned cynical. Lacking a central direction in civic life, Americans began searching for it in narrow spheres. Despairing over the numbing complexity of what Cornel West calls a decaying civilization, Americans avidly began talking about new ideals of total social cooperation and testing them out on small scales. By the mid-1990s, pundits agreed that America was deep into a new era of lost purpose and shattered consensus, what William Raspberry called an unraveling. A series of jolts propelled this new mood. The 1987 stock crash and ensuing Wall Street scandals cut short the jovial talk about the "greed is good" yuppie. The Cold War and Desert Storm victories produced a new world order that felt ephemeral and disquieting. The collapse of healthcare reform confirmed that America no longer had faith that big institutional solutions could solve public problems. The whipsaw elections of 1992 through 1996 accelerated the de-alignment of national politics. The Oklahoma City bombing revealed maniacal passions seething just beneath the surface. The Simpson trial and Million Man March evoked a sullen new racialism. With each jolt, yet another piece of the old order lay in disrepute, its workings less respected, its directions less tolerable, its outcomes less predictable. The 1990s are generating plenty of what in other eras would pass for good news. The economy perks along, and the stock market roars. School achievement is going up, the crime rate down. While the U.S. reigns as the sole superpower in a multilateral world, American culture is spreading all over the globe. The big hand on the atomic scientist's doomsday clock, which hit 3 minutes to midnight in 1984, has since retreated. Yet Americans are more pessimistic than ever. They're inclined to believe that any good news, like a roaring stock market, comes with a sinister edge, big layoffs, for which a price will someday be paid. The unraveling mood turn is a natural consequence of the life cycle transitions taking place among today's generations. The confident, entitled GIs are weakening. The other focused, compromise-minded silent are vacating midlife. Boomers are exiting young adulthood after having embroiled it in self-discovery, argument, and new social pathologies. The departure of 13ers from childhood leaves people of all ages, them included, wondering what went wrong. New millennial babies are being born. The society is moving into an archetypal constellation that will reach an apogee of inner, private power and a nadir of outer, public power. Like other eras, an unraveling is a natural phase of human history. Now is the time a society clears away institutional detritus. With the awakening over and no crisis yet on the horizon, an unraveling enables people to live life to the fullest, consume off the past, and pursue individual ends. Human civilization would be far poorer without such an opportunity, once per seculum, to explore the private realms of self-fulfillment, even if it comes with public pessimism. In many ways, a third turning can be the most personally enjoyable of the secular seasons. So too is an unraveling a necessary phase. By empowering the ideals of the awakening, it lays the agenda for the crisis to follow. As in other turnings, the mood of an unraveling results from the gradual aging of the generational archetypes. Artists entering elderhood, prophets entering midlife, nomads coming of age, and heroes being born. Entering old age, artists remain as other-directed as before, institutionally flexible, culturally sensitive, and committed to process and expertise. They seldom produce strong, decisive leaders. Just as they once took cues from hero elders, they now adopt the agenda of younger prophets while wishing to be accepted as full partners in the new values regime. Entering midlife, prophet generations display first a reflective distance and gradually a sober severity in a phase of life previously known for tolerance. Midlife prophets begin reshaping institutions from the inside out, taking the insights they had earlier cultivated in private life and projecting them into public life. They come to political power slowly but resolutely, beginning with relatively weak leaders tolerant of their peers' self-immersed impulses. As they re-sacralize institutions not in line with their values, passionate splits emerge between factions with competing moral positions. Lacking a generational core, young nomads are defined by their very social and cultural divergence. Galvanized as individuals, they take entrepreneurial risks and begin sorting themselves into winners and losers. Their culture develops a frenetic, hardened quality, provoking next elder prophets to accuse them of lacking a principled inner life. Nomads shake off these criticisms and do what they must to get by. Child heroes are nurtured with increasing protection by pessimistic adults in an insecure environment. Children are urged to be obedient achievers and team players. To older prophet parents, hero children are instruments through which their inner visions can someday be achieved. To younger nomad parents, they are beneficiaries of a hard-fought effort to rediscover and reclaim a close family life. America is now more than a decade into the current unraveling, with roughly another decade remaining. Over the next 10 years or so, the usual linear forecasts are correct. Into the new millennium, today's generations will display much the same persona as they do now, except in a more exaggerated and slightly older form. But in so doing, they will be traveling to the threshold of yet another transformation whose nature and consequences the linearists cannot fathom. Starting at the top of the Unraveling's generational constellation, let's take a look at the Silent Generation as they enter elderhood. The Silent are well on the way to becoming the first generation in U.S. history never to produce a president. They haven't even had a vice president. Yet they have established themselves as a preeminent helpmate generation, with three first ladies, Jackie Kennedy, Rosalynn Carter, Barbara Bush, and an unprecedented 4 decades of behind-the-scenes prominence on White House staffs, from Pierre Salinger, Joe Califano, and Bill Moyers in the 60s, to Dave Gergen, Mac McClarty, and Leon Panetta in the 1990s. During the Awakening, the Silent helped an older generation run the nation and a younger generation challenge those elders. During the Unraveling, when the Silent should have taken charge, they have helped GIs linger and boomers pass them by. Having spent a lifetime looking beyond themselves, the Silent reached their turn at leadership only to find others looking beyond them too. Their elder accomplishments, adding new definitions of fairness, new layers of process, new levels of expertise, and new categories of diversity, enhanced the amenities but did little to address the nation's core challenges. Like the law many Silent deem their greatest achievement, the Americans with Disabilities Act, their best efforts always helped somebody out but tied other people in knots. Now, as the Unraveling deepens and power drifts away, this generation feels a post-midlife passage that Daniel Levinson has described as a silent despair, a pressing fear of becoming irrelevant. Wincing at younger generations' troubles with the Unraveling-era economy, the Silent are embarking on old age feeling a vague dissatisfaction about their supposed luck as an inheritor generation grown old. They comprise America's wealthiest ever elders, completing a stunning 2-generation rags-to-riches transformation of American old age. Where the high era lost watched their growing offspring whiz past them economically, the Silent tower over the living standards of their children. Much as David Broder closes each year with a column acknowledging his gaffes, the Silent are closing their careers by reflecting on their mistakes and how they might make amends. Retired public officials admit easily to past errors, yet are annoyed to hear their legislative artifacts of tolerance, compassion, and due process come under sharp attack from younger politicians. Unfortunately, lamented Pat Schroeder upon announcing her retirement, the Washington I'm leaving is meaner than it was when I arrived. What chills the blood of aging liberals like Daniel Moynihan is the realization that in their youth, the old bastards were the conservatives. Now the young people are becoming the conservatives, and we are the old bastards. As more Silent incumbents retire rather than persevere, this generation's core of expertise is becoming ever more irrelevant. Through the rest of the Unraveling, the Silent will rejuvenate what it means to be old in America. Leisure World and Sun City will lose popularity, as Silent tastemakers prefer townhomes within reach of restaurants, theaters, and sports arenas patronized and run by younger people. Boomerang households will mature into extended families that can endure. Older people with hopelessly fractured families will experiment with non-traditional living arrangements. Many will be old goofballs, more childlike than their grandchildren. Others will become expert at what they dabbled in when young. They will travel to national parks with their smocks and berets, easels and paints. They will turn their basements into photo labs, recording studios, or computer workshops. In the decade ahead, the Silent will find themselves the unwitting fulcrum of a sweeping turn in America's attitudes about old-age public dependency. Unlike GIs, the Silent will not feel entitled. They came of age in the careerist 1950s, not in do-without 1930s or the global war 1940s. Their prior public deeds will not inspire them, or others, to lobby for a vast elder reward. Moreover, younger people will ask why government treats elderhood as perennial dependency if so many Unraveling-era golden oldies are able to live such aesthetically fulfilling lives and in such gorgeous pleasure palaces. Given the diverging economic fortunes of the low-benefit McJobs worker and the early retiring and golden-parachuted pensioner, many young people will express resentment at seeing their large FICA taxes going to pay for a year in Provence or a master bedroom jacuzzi. The silent would be easy targets for generational war, except that their open-mindedness and un-GI-like fascination with youth will make them elders whom younger people enjoy being around. To deflect the inevitable youth criticisms, the silent will play to the heart and suggest intergenerational co-caretaking, reasserting the mutual duties between young and old. Their sense of guilt and instinct for compromise will compel them to give in some, relax their claims on young workers, and drain the electricity out of the third rail of Social Security politics. As the silent offer to accept a modest but important measure of sacrifice, they will succeed in completing their lives without ever having had a major quarrel with another generation, cementing their reputation as the most other-directed generation of their time. Next, let's examine the boomer generation's entrance into midlife. When the GI Lloyd Benson told Dan Quayle, "You are no Jack Kennedy," the insult was partly generational. In midlife, boomers are not GIs. They are not as eager to take JFK-style long strides or get America moving again as they are to think deep thoughts or get America to tend its soul. Offering themselves as America's midlife magistrates of morality, boomers are stirring to defend values, monogamy, thrift, continence, that other generations do not associate with them. Today's boomer-style values politics had its roots in the Awakening. The temperament of the boomer-dominated Congress has a recognizable link to the 60s kids in jeans with bullhorns. What the New York Times calls the new churlishness echoes what occurred once on radicalized Awakening-era campuses. Now, as before, the advantage goes to whomever yells the loudest and has the best conversation enders. Everything gets hyperbolized. In boomer battles over symbols, polarization is easy, compromise hard. In 1992, when Americans elected their first boomer president, his campaign slogan, "It's the economy, stupid," and governance showed a distinctly generational flavor. Bill Clinton is smart but distractible, habitually late to an event or issue, after which he focuses like a laser beam. Gifted in gestures of empathy, Clinton can persuasively flaunt his inner self to enhance his popularity. As a candidate and president, he has reminded many people, including his own peers, of his generation's best and worst qualities. The 1994 Republican onslaught was the first election determined by boomer votes, and the 20th century's largest generational landslide. In the states, boomer governorships rose from 18 to 28, empowering a new peer-driven movement to devolve power to the states. In the House, boomers gained the Speaker's chair and a solid majority. Only the U.S. Senate resisted the tide and remained in silent hands, where it acquired the telling reputation as an island of politeness and moderation. As boomers stoked the talk shows, their first Congress drowned out consensus seekers, talked openly of default, and demanded that the government be reformed or closed. Thus has the American government, from GI to silent to boom, gone from moonwalk to gridlock to train wreck. By 1996, the Clinton-Dole race, between the talker and the doer, updated the old boomer-GI generation gap. Dole was a standard-issue GI on one last mission for my generation. Not an evangelical, not a credentialed culture warrior, not a person who could grok values in the now-dominant boomer tongue. His nomination speech was critical of the boomer elite, who, he said, never grew up, never did anything real, never sacrificed, never suffered, and never learned. The mere nomination of Dole was a slap in the face to a generation that, he implied, lacked the character to exercise power responsibly. Dole's peers had earlier turned over leadership to their grown children. Now, said Al Gore, it's not fair to take back the reins. Before the early 90s, when boomers finally wrested national power from GIs, most of those who wanted to turn the status quo upside down had argued with, but mostly voted for, Democrats. Since then, those who felt like revolutionaries argued with, but mostly voted for, Republicans. Between 1987 and 1994, the Times Mirror survey chronicled a doubling of moralist types as a share of all voters, two-thirds of the increase coming from boomers alone. By the mid-1990s, more than twice as many boomers came to call themselves conservatives than liberals, a difference that said less about their politics than about their self-perception as totally rooted and self-secure, beyond the reach of opinion or edict or even sociability.